breaking ball and a call. Strike three. Third strikeout for Zach.
He's going to just watch it go. A grand slam for Bryson Stott.
And there's a high fly ball. Deep right field. Harper watches it fly.
From WHYY, this is Hittin' Season, a Philadelphia Phillies podcast. My name is Justin Clue. I write for Baseball Prospectus. The Phillies had a big win in Game 1 of their series with the Blue Jays on Tuesday night. On Wednesday, Mick Abel is scheduled to make his second Major League start. And on Thursday, we're hopefully talking about a sweep in Toronto. We're going to talk with the editor of PhilliesMinorThoughts.com, Matt Winkleman, in a minute to discuss what Abel's been up to since he dominated the Pirates in his big league debut a few weeks ago. But first, Bryce Harper came back and the Phillies started hitting. Starting over across the border in Toronto last night after that Brewers sweep at home, the second time the Phillies have been swept at home in 3 years. The previous time was against the Yankees, but an anomaly that I'm sure the Phillies are very eager to wipe from their memories. Well, they refreshed themselves after four straight losses and an off day with a big-time 8-3 victory over the Blue Jays on Tuesday night. Bryce Harper was back in the lineup after being pulled for a few days. He was dinged on the elbow by that Spencer Strider pitch, but no more discomfort there, as far as you know we could tell, given what he did in this game after coming back. The Phillies clocked in early, with six runs on the board, while some people were likely still tuning in and finding out that Scott Fransky was in the TV broadcast booth as Tom McCarthy had moved over to TBS to do a Cleveland Guardians game. Because that just, you know, that just happens sometimes, apparently. Toronto starter Bowden Francis managed to get five outs in his entire start. And they all were squeezed in between Phillies runs and hits. And he was out of the game before the end of the second frame. That had mostly to do with the two-run home run Trey Turner blasted off after Bryson Stott's leadoff walk. And the bomb Bryce Harper hit in the next at-bat, his first since returning to the lineup, on an 0-2 count that gave the Phillies a 3-0 lead. After an Alec Bohm single and Nick Castellanos was hit by a pitch, Max Kepler hit a one-out RBI ground ball single up the middle. As the Phillies batted around in the first, singles by JT Realmuto and Bryson Stott made the score 6-0. That's what you want to see. I mean, you know, we talk about what kind of team this is all the time, and I don't expect the overall makeup of this team to shift as the season goes on. So this is a roster, and frankly, a starting rotation that with six runs should be able to win a ball game. You know, I think obviously we saw the opposite of that in the Brewers series when the Phillies lost 17-7. But again, that almost proves that point, which is that in that game there was a very unlikely 12 earned run scenario for Jesus Luzardo. It is funny that when the Phillies pitchers have stumbled this year, in at least two occasions, it's been the worst start of their career, which feeds into the idea that these missteps are more anomalous than indicative of overall problems, at least with Luzardo. With Aaron Nola, that still remains to be seen. He's expected back in the Phillies rotation by mid-June. That staff that just got all shaken up was on display in this game as well. We'll get to that in a little bit. Not in the most aggressive way, but we'll get to that in a little bit. Thankfully, the Phillies didn't have to lean on their bullpen too much because they staked Christopher Sanchez to a 6-0 start early. And yeah, I mean, anytime you can do that, that's going to help any pitcher, but it's really going to help these Phillies pitchers, you know, take any kind of pressure off, let them do their thing. And their ceilings are high enough that they should be able to dominate a lineup and at least keep them from matching a 6-run outburst that the Phillies managed to put up early. So yeah, that's nothing but good news to tune in and see that the Phillies have already put somebody in a hole, especially after a weekend where it felt like they were playing from down in a hole very, very early on in at least two of those games against the Brewers. Well, the Phillies eked out another run in the second when Nick Castellanos launched a fly ball to left fielder Addison Barger, who's played the role of hero of late for the Blue Jays as they've been a bit depleted as well, missing Anthony Santander and Dalton Varsho and various other contributors to their lineup. Barger made the catch, and Harper, who was on second after being walked, tagged up to go to third. Barger's throw went a couple of body lengths wide of the third base bag, well out of range of the third baseman's human arms, and Harper scampered home with the Phillies' seventh run. I mentioned Castellanos there. I do want to just go back and say I've kind of characterized his season as a little quieter than everybody else. Honestly, It's not true. It's just incorrect. He has the second spot on the team in hit total for the year. He's got 63 hits. The only person with more hits than him is Trey Turner. And all we can talk about is how Trey Turner's really been on one and is on pace for some milestones that he's never achieved offensively in his career. And his career is very impressive. So that Castellanos is, you know, the first guy behind him is a sign that he is getting the ball in play. He is making solid contact. He is, you know, contributing. He's just not a guy that whose name has popped up in the headlines a whole lot this year. I guess we might have to wait till August or September. That's typically the time of year when he takes center stage, even if he has been hitting the ball earlier in the season. But in any case, the Phillies had 7 runs pretty quick in game 1 against the Blue Jays. Christopher Sanchez got the start for the Phillies, going 6 innings, allowing 4 hits, 1 earned run, 4 walks, and 4 strikeouts. It was a crisp start, though those walks stick out a bit. 4 is Christopher Sanchez's highest single-game walk total of the season. He's walked at least 3 and 5 out of 12 starts so far this year, and he threw 55 of 96 pitches for strikes. But when he was in trouble, he was typically able to induce the ground balls he needed to get out of it and wound up with his 6th quality start of the season. So another good start from Christopher Sanchez. You know, we're going to hear in a second here, he did fall victim to his pitfall, which is giving up home runs. But yeah, all in all, nothing to really complain about here, even though, you know, he was not showing as pinpoint the command as he needs to make his stuff work. He's, as I said, he's shown a Nola-esque propensity for giving up the home run ball on occasion, and that happened last night when Davis Schneider of the Blue Jays got a hold of one in the 5th, but Trey Turner got it right back with his 2nd homer of the night, a solo shot into the Blue Jays bullpen. Boy, after watching Christian Yelich and Rhys Hoskins both have multi-homer games against the Phillies this past weekend, nice to see them kind of show that that's something they are capable of as well. It's not just something they are the victim of. It is something that they can do to other teams as well. So good to see Turner, you know, get right back on it and stay hot and, you know, just have a generally excellent night at the plate. You know, you want to see that continue. You want all this success at the plate that him and Harper, having returned, have been seeing, and having him have a 2-homer game like this, you know, it's good to see him go off. But it's good to see them go off not like in a completely insane way. I'm sure there are people out there who are looking at like 7 runs early and thinking, well, then they kind of dropped off and they didn't score again, even after getting into the Blue Jays bullpen. So, you know, how effective really were they? How much promise can we really glean from this? I'm going to talk a little bit more about that general idea later, but I'll mainly just say, as we all know, if the Phillies score like 18 runs against a team, for whatever reason, they just don't score for the next couple days, or at least the next day. I mean, you know, you generally want to see them put up, I feel like, 8-9 runs. That's the sweet spot, you know, that you're probably going to win that game. Again, with this pitching staff, you're almost assuredly going to win that game. You don't need to go overboard and, quote-unquote, use up all your offense for the week. Just 8 or 9 runs, that's a sweet spot for you, and they got there pretty quick. So, you know, no complaints from me in that regard. And, you know, Sanchez gave up a home run, you know, it was a pretty isolated event. So as far as that being an issue for him, really wasn't much of one in this game. Addison Barger, he had a last gasp of effort for the Blue Jays in the 9th inning while they were down 8-1. Sanchez's night was done by that point. The Phillies had sent Joe Ross, Max Lazar, and Carlos Hernandez in from the bullpen. Lazar was the one who gave up the 2-run home run to the young Blue Jay Barger, but Hernandez pitched a clean 9th, and the Phillies secured an 8-3 win without even having to turn to their newest high-leverage reliever, Taijuan Walker. I'm kidding, sort of. The Phillies' win in Game 1 of this 3-game set was fueled largely by that big first inning, which made me go back and look at what the Phillies have been able to do inning by inning offensively this season. Truth is, I don't have a whole lot of conclusions for you. You look at what their average, what their slash lines are from the 1st to the 9th, and honestly, you know, yeah, things, numbers go up and down, but for the most part, this is kind of just a good team that doesn't need a particular inning to go off. I believe their best inning this year has been the 3rd, in which they're slugging .461 with an .817 OPS. So that's probably their most powerful inning. Their highest stat, it certainly is their highest stat of that kind in any inning. They've hit 10 home runs. They only have more than that in one other inning, which is the fourth, in which they have 11. So generally around the third or fourth, I guess you could say, is where this offense will typically take off, really start, you know, making solid contact and driving the ball. But their slugging and on-base numbers drop considerably from the third to the fourth, even though the home run total goes up. If you're a believer in batting average, the second inning is also strong for the Phillies, as they're hitting almost 300 in the second frame this season as a team, and they're hitting 286 in the fifth. So, like I said, you can find solid numbers in pretty much any inning, even though, you know, things, the various different stats go up and down. I felt like they probably weren't a big first inning team instinctively. Like last night, that felt kind of like an isolated event. They don't typically hit a guy immediately, even when they're being aggressive. Especially with Schwarber not hitting leadoff as much and, you know, setting a new single season record for leadoff home runs again this year. But the first inning is also productive for these 2025 Phillies, as it is the inning in which they've knocked in, along with the fifth, as in which they've knocked in the most runs with 38. So you can't really say they're an unproductive team in the first inning. It's where they get a lot of their runs. The Phillies might just be a pretty good team across the board, as you can make an argument that they've found a way to excel in every inning except the ninth. They've certainly had some big moments then, but the 2025 Phillies are not typically a strong ninth inning team, at least not in the numbers. They're hitting 219 with a 589 OPS in that frame, along with 63 total bases, their lowest single inning total. And they've got 45 hits in the ninth as opposed to 72 in the second, which is where you stop and go, oh, right. They are good enough that they don't always have to play the ninth inning. So you could call that a limited sample size anyway. So really, I don't think there's an inning that's particularly bad for the Phillies offense. Pitching, yeah, we all know what innings to avoid with the pitching staff. But as far as the hitting goes, I don't know. I mean, I feel like they can come at you pretty much at any time during the game. So there's no crazy anomalies there as far as I could see. But I hesitate to veer too far into how the Phillies win games. I realize it may indicate what future walls this team could run into. Like, oh, I'm seeing issues here. I'm seeing issues here. I'm seeing issues here. I'm just not finding myself really interested in that right now. In a tight race like this, all that matters is the numbers in the win column. And fortunately for the Phillies, the Braves, and more importantly, the Mets, both lost last night, putting the Phillies only half a game behind New York in the NL East standings. So, you know, I'm not particularly interested, especially since there's not an issue on an inning by inning basis or any kind of niche problem for the Phillies, especially when they, you know, go off and score eight runs. You know, that looks great. I really don't want to complain that, like, oh, strength of opponent matters, or, you know, playing on the road versus at home matters, which, you know, again, I'm not sure it really does for this team. But even if you want to make that argument, I just don't think that's important right now. Winning games is important no matter who they're playing, no matter when they're playing. You know, you got to just win, because Mets aren't going away and the Braves are going to make some kind of noise at some point. That's going to make life difficult for everybody else. It's the Braves. That's what they do. Well, back to the Mets. They lost in especially satisfying fashion last night, getting walked off by Freddie Freeman and the Dodgers in Los Angeles. It's been a pretty entertaining series out there. A great epilogue to the evening, generally, for baseball fans on the East Coast who can check in for some late-night playoff baseball. I do think that's ideal. As like, if you've got a night free to just watch some baseball, and you watch the Phillies game that's on, you know, probably like 6:45, 7, and then that game wraps up, and then you can watch the Mets. And you know, if they lose, then, wow, what a 1-2 combo. What a doubleheader. A Phillies win and a Mets loss. I don't know if there's a fresher combo you can find in baseball. The Mets went up 1-0, and then the Dodgers, like the Phillies, had a big first inning on Tuesday night to take a 4-1 lead on a Freddie Freeman double and a Max Muncy bomb. Max Muncy loves beating the Phillies, and Freddie Freeman loves hitting RBI doubles, as we're going to, you know, hear again later. Freeman, he's typically, I think you can consider him a Mets killer, but the Mets scored 4 unanswered runs before the ninth inning as a gradually and finally heating up Juan Soto hit his 11th home run of the season, and the still hot Pete Alonso hit a big double to make it 5-4 in New York. I mean, after all this talk about Soto getting off to a slow start, doesn't it feel a little cliche for him to suddenly start turning it around? I mean, how many New York underdogs do we really need to be reading about on a daily basis? I prefer the Juan Soto narrative to be that we all know he's extremely good, you know, Ted Williams comparisons and everything, that he is one of the best players playing today, that he deserved the deal he got, or the mega deal that that he was set to get in free agency and that the Mets gave to him, that he's, you know, an absolute superstar of a player. I want us to all be able to acknowledge that while he hits like 205 and strikes out in like 55% of his at bats or something. Like I want him to struggle with the Mets so that he, you know, that can still be a talking point for them. I don't know if you heard WFAN in New York going on the somewhat viral rant about Karl Anthony Towns and the Knicks elimination from the NBA playoffs, but you know, you can feel pretty good about Phillies baseball when New York sports radio enters a state like that. It generally means there's something going on that's legitimately bad, but people are ready to blow it out of proportion for the sake of the narrative, and then they just start like feeding on each other like a pile of rats. That's where you want the Mets to be, I think, generally. That's where you want them to be when you're tuning in for that late night game, and just know that, yeah, Juan Soto, great player, but struggling. So that he's really starting to heat up, that's unfortunate for anybody not wearing a Mets uniform. Also, like the Phillies, the Dodgers got a two-homer night to fuel their offense, this one coming from Max Muncy, who homered to lead off the ninth as well and tie the game. L.A. walked it off in the ninth on a fly ball from Freddie Freeman that Brandon Nimmo misjudged in left field kind of horribly. But if you ask him or his manager, Carlos Mendoza, well, it's not really his fault because the ball moved. MLB.com's Anthony DiComo writes, when he looked up, Nimmo realized the ball had shifted, in his estimation, a good 15 feet to his right. He tried to adjust, looking back over his other shoulder to find the ball again, but at that point, his fate was sealed. The ball shifted. Is doing some heavy lifting there? I don't know. I mean, look, I'm not going to sit here and say that was an easy play. He's lying and he just didn't make it. That's not what I'm saying. But it is just kind of like, what was the issue again? Oh, the ball shifted. I mean, fly balls do that. But all right, hey, whatever. Who am I to say a catch could have been made? You know, I'm just a non-athlete recording my own voice by myself, talking about someone failing to do something that would have been very impressive. On the other hand, I mean, balls are going to shift, Brandon. You got to be able to adjust, especially with the game on the line. But whatever. Hey, just as winning however they can is crucial for the Phillies, the Mets losing however they can lose is also crucial for the Phillies, or at least good. Or at least fun to watch. We love to see the Mets get walked off, and we love that it went right over Nimmo's head. I'm sure by saying that, I have evoked a fate in which Brandon Nimmo like hits like four or five walk-offs against the Phillies this season. There's a couple of hot teams out there right now. The Phillies just ran into one back home when the Brewers swept them with seeming ease. But the Blue Jays were also hot coming into this one as well, winning six of their last seven, including a four-game sweep of the A's. And I just mentioned that to say momentum can really pivot easily this time of year. And frankly, the Phillies losing four games in a row, yeah, I mean, it's unideal, but their month of May was so good and so productive. They're right up there among the teams that, you know, every day there's a new team with the best record in baseball, because it's early enough in the season that that can still be the case. But it's also late enough in the season that the teams that want to separate themselves from the pack have successfully done so. Well, some teams have separated themselves from the pack. I'm not going to say that all the teams that wanted to have done that, because that's simply not true. But some teams have done that, and the Phillies are one of those teams. The Mets are one of those teams. The Tigers are one of those teams. Obviously, the Dodgers and Yankees are some of those teams. But my point is that you can run into a team that's starting to figure things out this time of year, like the Brewers, who were struggling, and then Phillies were kind of made a part of their phase one of their hot streak. They certainly played like a different team against the Phillies, and the Blue Jays pretty hot, but the Phillies can get hot again, and they can get hot against a team that's hot. So heat is contagious, I guess. It can get transferred from one team to the other, or a good team can just beat a good team, and the Phillies can do that. They can beat a good team that's on a good run. They can beat a bad team that's on a good run. And clearly they can beat bad teams that are on bad runs, because that road trip proved, you know, if you're making yourself out to be nothing but a speed bump in Major League Baseball this year, the Phillies will drive over you at full speed. They don't care what kind of damage it does to their car. They'll just run you over. So, yeah, momentum, not maybe as much of a factor this time of year as it winds up being in September and October. To that point, the Phillies are 18-11 on the road. It's great. I mean, they're even better at home. They're also 8-2 versus the American League. also something that was not always the case. And when we say that, we're talking about like a different group of players from a totally different era. So, you know, as far as like a measuring stick, there kind of isn't one. But it's just good to see the Phillies as a team succeeding against the American League. That used to be the bane of their existence once interleague play started. They could not beat American League teams. So it's good to see them winning 8 out of 10 so far this season. Well, up next, as you might have heard, Mick Abel has had his start moved up. He was originally scheduled to start on Thursday. Zach Wheeler was going to have a start in Game 1 of this series on Tuesday night. But anybody who saw the TikTok knows Zach Wheeler has gone to be with his wife as they give birth to another child. So he is on paternity leave, and that means Mick Abel's start has been moved up, and he will take on Jose Barrios. And Jesus Luzardo looks to give up fewer than double-digit runs as he faces Chris Bassett in Game 3 of this series in Toronto. I ran through how the Phillies individually have done against Bassett in our last episode. Spoiler alert. Most of them hit him pretty hard. But against Barrios, the Phillies have far less experience. Nick Castellanos has unquestionably seen him the most, and he's done quite well. In 21 at-bats, he's hitting .381 lifetime against Jose Barrios with a .952 OPS. Again, I keep thinking Casty's having a quiet year, but he's slashing solid numbers. He just had that. Part of that is maybe just recency bias. He had just one hit in that Brewers series, and he's been hitless in his last three games. However, facing a pitcher he's done really well against in the past, could always be a nice solve for a hitter. Last May, against Barrios, Castellanos wasted no time in a Phillies-Blue Jays game, cracking a double down the left field line in the first inning of a 10-1 thumping of Toronto. That was a game in which Bryce Harper hit a grand slam, and Cody Clemens also had a big day at the plate. I think he had a triple in that game, an RBI triple. Well, one more thing about last night I noticed. NBC sports analyst Ben Davis was talking about Bryce Harper missing some games and how with like 102 games left on the season, you know, it's okay to do that. He's not like slipping out when he doesn't have to during a pennant race or something. I mean, who would do that other than Anthony Rendon, I guess. But, you know, Davis was saying it was probably the right thing to hold him back. He matters so much to this team. He is their superstar, this offense. You know, he can be the engine of it when he's in the batting line, when he's in the batting order. And all I could think was back a couple of weeks ago when Davis was given a really self-aggrandizing personal critique of Alec Bohm because Bohm was wearing protective gear at the plate to prevent himself from getting hurt. And Davis was bragging about how when he played, he would just go up to the plate. I think he was saying he wouldn't even wear batting gloves, or he would just wear batting gloves or something. And it was just like one of those, first of all, I don't know if this is an area that even needs to be critiqued unless a guy's going up there wearing like a homemade Transformer costume. But the other side of that is that you get these guys sometimes that want to give a critique like this to a player because it means they get to talk about themselves and how tough they are. It's just good sense when Harper misses time to be sure about an injury. But if Bohm, who has the second highest batting average on the Phillies behind Trey Turner, by the way, tries to prevent injury, well, then he's just being ridiculous. And, you know, whatever else Davis was trying to insinuate with that kind of commentary. Okay. I think sometimes these ex-player analysts can, you know, maybe they feel a little bit wistful on a particular day, or maybe they feel a little forgotten, and they use the broadcast as a means to, you know, talk themselves up. But hey, I guess some people's MLB careers are just more forgettable than others. You know who we didn't see last night? Our old pal Jeff Hoffman. Jordan Romano got his moment to wave at the crowd in Toronto. He was back in the building of his old team and his home country last night. But his counterpart on the Jays, former Phillies closer Jeff Hoffman, did not appear. He did not come out of the bullpen for Toronto. Makes sense. Again, they were down 6-0 very early, and the game never really got close. So, yeah, you probably weren't going to see him. Hoffman finished April with a 1.17 ERA after 13 games. You know, I think we're all probably pretty aware of Hoffman's stats because of how closely they were being tracked in the wake of Romano's struggles early on, but then May came around, and around the time that Romano was starting to get into a scoreless groove for the Phillies, Hoffman hit something of a wall, and he had, I think, a worse time than Romano ever did, even in his more disastrous strings of starts. I mean, I looked at his numbers and they were even worse than I thought they were going to be. In the month of May, Jeff Hoffman had a 13.50 ERA through 12 games. And yeah, you know, it's in a 12 game sample size, you're looking at what, like three games that went really badly, but three games that went really badly, including one where he gave up five earned runs, is enough to change people's minds about what kind of closer you are, especially when you're on a, you're new to a team and, you know, it's within the first 2 months of the season. And especially when it's such a huge departure from the success you had in a very similar sample size 1 month before. Again, I don't know, you know, you tell me when you want to start drawing conclusions. It's you know, early June, so whatever. But something to note is that Jeff Hoffman has just had two very different months in a season that's only 2 months old. So we'll see what happens there. But I think a lot of people are waiting to see just what they're going to get from Hoffman in Toronto in the month of June. Matt Gelb's got a great piece on Hoffman and his memories of Philadelphia on The Athletic today. They talk about a Philly street sign that says Hoffman on it that he had, and he thought he lost it, and then he found it in his locker during this trip. So it's, yeah, it's nice. They're keeping in touch in the way that baseball players do. First pitch on Wednesday is 7:07 at the Rogers Center. Tomorrow we get a day game with a 3:07 start. And remember, that's Mick Abel and then Jesus Luzardo. And hey, we're going to talk to Matt Winkleman in a minute here about Mick Abel, but as a programming note, I just wanted to let everybody know that hitting season is going on vacation very briefly until next week, so do not expect a regular podcasting schedule over the weekend. We'll be back to discuss the Toronto series next week. A few weeks ago, Phillies pitching prospect Mick Abel showed up in the major leagues. It was a jarring development for the once top pitching prospect, who was considered right up there with Andrew Painter for a minute, but dropped off in the 2024 season, finishing that year with a 6.46 ERA and 108 innings pitched for Lehigh Valley. A common complaint was that he had the stuff, but not the control, something scouts attributed to his lanky frame. He wasn't throwing strikes and finished with at least three walks in well over half of his appearances. Going into 2025, Abel rose to the challenge, worked on his mental skills, and looked promising enough that when the Phillies needed a guy, the 23-year-old on the comeback trail with the Iron Pigs was that guy. Cut two, Mick Abel shutting out the Pirates over six innings with nine Ks and no walks on May 18th. He was patted on the back, thanked for his services, and sent back down to make room on the roster. Now in the month of May, down in the minors, Abel has a 0.94 ERA through 28 and two-thirds innings, 40 strikeouts to 13 walks, and opponents are hitting 183 against him. Hitting being a generous way to put that. All this to say, he, in his last start, struck out eight batters and at one point had the Iron Pigs TV broadcaster reduced to chuckling. He's put up great numbers, but there's been some other things to note as well before his second ever big league start on Thursday against the Blue Jays. Joining us now is Matt Winkleman, the overseer of PhilliesMinorThoughts.com and an authority on the Phillies farm system. Matt, thanks for joining us on Hitting Season.
Good to be here.
Now, Matt, like anybody monitoring the Phillies minor leagues right now, what's Mick Abel been up to since we last saw him in the majors? I mean, I just cited those pretty impressive sounding numbers, but I mean, you know, these people probably aren't seeing the starts themselves and are able to evaluate him on a pitch by pitch or start by start basis. So in your mind, what's he been up to since we last saw him dominating the Pirates?
Yeah, it's been very similar to what he looked like before he came up the first time, which is not as pinpoint of control as he had on his debut. Fastball velocity's back down about a mile per hour or so from where he was. So, but versus the Pirates, he was, what, 97, 98. There were some 99s in there. In the minors, he's been back more to that 95 to 97. You'll see some 98s early, some 94s later, which is exactly where he was prior to that first call-up. The command's been just not quite as crisp. It's not like he's throwing the ball around, but he's doing all the good things he was doing before. Innings aren't spiraling. Generally he's keeping runners off the bases, generating poor contact when hitters are getting to him. So I think a bit more what we thought we would get last time he was up. But we got that dominating outing, and now he's sort of back to where he was before without all of that adrenaline of that debut.
Yeah, after a recent start in which Abel followed up a dominant performance down in the minors with four walks, frequent traffic on the base paths, and a little less heat on his heater, you wrote that, quote, it was a disappointing start if you wanted to see the dominance from last week carry over. But if you thought his season up to this point had been good, this was just more of how good he has been in AAA this year. How wide would you say the gap is between people's expectations for Abel's next big league start and what he's actually capable of, what he's actually capable of in your mind?
Oh, wow. So I think what we saw last time is probably the peak. I think there's a chance Mick Abel is going to be frustrating to fans just because you're going to see those flashes. I think there's a good chance his outcome is somewhere like a mid-rotation-ish starter that occasionally does enough to make you believe there's an ace in there. And certainly what he did versus the Pirates makes you think there's like a really dominant pitcher in there. But there's probably some days when he's out in the fifth because he's hit a high pitch count. And there's going to be some of that give and take. I don't think he's going to maintain that velocity he had versus the Pirates. The fact that he sort of returned to that lower velocity indicates that was a little bit unsustainable. Also, I think he had 7 days off before that Pirates start. I think he's going Wednesday now. I think that was just the change. And I do not remember what days of that'd be the fourth. I think that's going to be on normal rest for him. So there's not going to be that time to really build up and really let it loose. And I think we're going to see someone who's going to be a little bit pitchery. There's going to be some pitch mixing in some of the secondaries later. Really trying to keep guys off balance a little bit more than just blowing away with fastballs.
You want to believe a young pitcher who comes up and looks great is that guy, no matter what the evaluations have said before that, you want to believe, oh wow, this guy just came up and is looked incredible, and it looks like we have a guy. This is great, incredible, what a development. But there are, like you mentioned, a couple of X factors that went into that start. All the rest, he was able to have a level of control and velocity that maybe we hadn't seen before. And it was pointed out that his opposition was the Pirates, one of the worst lineups in Major League Baseball. None of this is to take away from the start. It was fantastic. And, I don't think anybody needs to think that he's a dramatically worse pitcher than he pitched in that game. Differences do exist between his normal output and what we saw that day. But how surprising was it to you personally to see him come up and pitch as well as he did with all those X factors in play?
Oh, it was completely shocking. It's the best I've ever seen him pitch. I mean, he was hitting the corners. He wasn't always getting that pitch called a strike by the umpire too, which was, it was fascinating. He had that great a start and he wasn't getting some of his pitches. And yeah, you do want to believe there's a part like that you want to latch onto that. This is like the Rafael Marchand hits home runs in the majors thing where just like the lights are on and suddenly he's better. I think I either posted or tweeted or not tweeted, whatever Blue Sky is these days, that at minimum what he did versus the Pirates shows that's in him. Whether that's a full start or can he be a guy that when that big moment is can reach back for that 99 or really focus in on that perfect slider. He definitely showed more with his curveball, I think, versus the Pirates than he has in the minors. Up until that start, he hadn't missed a single bat in the zone with the curveball, and I'm pretty sure he missed O'Neill Cruz's bat 3 or 4 times in the zone in that start alone. So there's definitely some stuff that he still has some learning to do. He's 23, he'll turn 24 in August, so there's still some nuances of pitching still to come. He's not a fully formed pitcher yet. And I think this sort of preps us for when like Andrew Painter comes up later and it's, well, there's going to be disappointing because you want everyone to be Paul Skeens. They show up and they're just an ace from day one.
Mm-hmm. And that's he's going to throw a ball in his first appearance and we're going to lose our minds. I will personally lose my mind. We were lied to. Yeah, it's expectations. It's tough. And you know, for a guy like Abel, he had some questions. Well, one big question to answer this year, and I want to ask you about that in a minute. But first, we're bringing up opposition and, you know, how much of a factor that is in a young pitcher's performance. And, you know, this time he's not going to be playing the pitching against the Pirates, but he will be pitching against the Blue Jays, who have a lineup full of hurt sluggers, underperformers, minor leaguers who are thriving in small temporary roles. How much of a challenge do the Blue Jays present to Mick Abel than the Pirates did?
I mean, they're definitely a better team. I think on some level, it's going to come down to him executing his pitches. This is the most cliche thing to say about a pitcher. opposing hitters can hit regardless of whether they're a bad lineup or not. We've seen this. We've seen terrible hitters just go off on aces. But if he can stay in the strike zone, which he did, I think that was probably the biggest thing versus the Pirates. He got strike one. And if he just keeps coming back to that, and I think that's been, even when you see like four walks in the minors in his first start back, 3 4 2/3 the last time, one of the biggest changes with him, and I wonder if this is about what we're about to talk about, is he walks a batter and he just goes back and he attacks the next hitter. And I think if he can execute his pitches, he's going to be competitive against any lineup. It's good stuff. It's not like Zach Wheeler dominating stuff, but it's major league stuff. We saw it.
And honestly, in the absence of a pitcher in that spot, you know, you want to be able to go to a guy like Mick Abel. Obviously, he's not going to be Zach Wheeler, especially not in his second major league start.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you got to understand this. He's up there to play a role, and he's playing it. He played it really well last time. The assumption is he will have a chance at playing it really well again this time. And as he does so, could you just let our audience know, what is Mick Abel's best weapon against big league hitters?
I personally think it's his slider, just because I think he can use it in a lot of different ways. But the way he's been throwing his curveball has been it's been a very good pitch, and it comes off the fastball really well. But I think he's one of the things about Abel is that he is not a one pitch or two pitch pitcher. And I think if you watch the Phillies enough, you get this feeling watching all of their pitchers outside of Chris Sanchez, who can just, here is a changeup, you aren't hitting it. But they have a lot of weapons, and I think the Phillies as a whole give their pitchers a lot of tools to work with, and I think the ability to go to all five different pitches is what is going to help him versus lineups, because the fastball has velocity, but it's not a dominant pitch, and we see him go to the sinker and get that ground ball. We see the curveball versus certain batters. I don't think we're going to go into a start and you're like, I'm waiting to see this beautiful slider from him, even though I think the slider is really good. I just think it's a really solid pitch that he can work with. But it's that whole array of pitches and learning to throw the changeup on the second or third time through when the guy hasn't seen it before, that is really that growth for him and what will help him versus major league hitters who are going to time up 102. I mean, we see this.
Is it a kind of a classic younger pitcher move when they have so many options like that to throw? I mean, it seems like a strength, but isn't it kind of common that a guy will get older and some pitches sort of combine into one pitch, or he kind of drops using a pitch that's not as effective and kind of focuses more on having three more effective pitches than like five or six less effective ones? Is that something you could see happening with Abel, or do you think that versatility is something he's going to hold on to?
Oh, I think it's something he's going to hold on to, and it's intentional. So, going back to that last start, for example, he threw a changeup to Andrew McCutchen after McCutchen fell off and not chased a few things. And I'm pretty sure it was the first changeup he'd thrown to a righty. He threw a sinker later to, I think, Adam Frazier, and it was the first sinker he'd thrown to a lefty all year. And what you actually see is versus a right-handed hitter, he's going to throw fastballs, four-seam fastballs, sinkers, sliders, and curveballs. And then versus lefties, you're going to see no sinkers, and you're going to see the more of the changeup, and you're going to see some more curveballs than the slider. And it's that sort of, you have different arsenals for different types of hitters, in the same way that we see Jesus Luzardo mostly throw the sweeper more to lefties, and he'll throw his traditional slider more to righties, and there's some overlap, but you have different tools for different jobs, and I think that's something the Phillies have really preached. It's all the way down the minors. You see almost all of them have two fastballs. Everyone has, I would say, a slower breaking ball and a harder breaking ball, and so that can be like a hard slider and a curveball. That could be like, we talk about Aaron Nola's cutter and then his sort of sweeping curveball, and it just gives you more tools and more looks you can show a major league hitter. And it's intentional, and I think in the middle of last season they really started to separate out that usage for Mick Abel, and this is how he throws in the minors, is he is this real delineation of his arsenal based on who he's pitching to.
So going into this season, the Philadelphia Daily News asked the question that you could have found anywhere, from the Baseball Prospectus Annual to any scouting report, about Mick Abel, which was 2024 a developmental speed bump or a warning sign? You know, it's the question. Any a guy has a bad year in the middle of some good years. It's the question you get asked no matter what. But I think what differentiates it is, what stage of your career are you in? And as a 23-year-old, yeah, that becomes the question. Oh, like, oh, is this really the kind of pitcher he is now? Did he just change into a bad one? Or was that just like a rough stretch that lasted all season and they've worked with him to make him better? As a younger pitcher, a team may be more willing to invest resources and you know, coaches and everything into helping you get back to where you were before. So it's always, you know, it's the question that gets asked, and it was asked about Abel, of course. So do you feel like, even by June 2nd of this season, do you feel like he's answered that question, and that it kind of proven that, yeah, look, I can still pitch really well, even, you know, with my flaws, proving 2024 was something of an anomaly? Or do you feel like he has more to prove to show that he's not that guy?
Yeah, I think 2024, it's not even just it was an anomaly. It was, well, I mean, he started out with a loss of velocity because of an illness in spring, and you can see like this slow tick up of velocity where he wasn't throwing 96 until July of last year. And he was trying to be too perfect. And I think he's really answered the questions about the velocity and the makeup and approach on the mound. I think those have been resoundingly answered. What type of pitcher is Mick Abel in the future, I think, is still being determined. He's still shaping his arsenal, honing in on the control and the pitchability and how he works through a start. So I don't think we know for what fully he's going to be, but if we're saying, oh, this guy can't throw strikes, his velocity is all over the place, he just gets hit around, things spiral, I think those things have been resoundingly answered, both on the mound and just how he's carried himself and how the coaches talk about him.
Yeah, can he throw strikes is a great question to be able to ask about a pitcher, and for him to say, yes, I can. It's been a real boon for the Phillies that Mick Abel can throw strikes. And looking forward to his next start. That was a lot of fun when he first came up, so I'm looking forward to seeing what else he can do at the major league level. We've been talking to Matt Winkelman, who runs PhilliesMinorThoughts.com. You can follow him on Blue Sky at Matt Winkelman. Matt, thanks for joining us on Hitting Season.
Yeah, you're welcome. This was fun.
Well, that'll do it for this episode of Hittin' Season. For more episodes of Hittin' Season every week, go to BillyPenn.com/Hittin' Season or anywhere you get your podcasts. For bonus Phillies podcasts, check out the Hittin' Season Patreon at Patreon.com/Hittin' Season. Thanks for listening, and from WHYY, that's the ballgame. We'll talk to you next time on Hittin' Season.